currently completing a master's of theology at Boston College, and you will hear more about her involvement and her presentation. Tim Clayton is the founder and former pastor of the Eleuthero community, a small Christian community in Portland, Maine, focused on issues of Christian life and faith as they nexus with care for the earth and the poor. He is now assistant rector at St. John's Episcopal Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. And Josh Kaufman Horner is one of the founders of the Mission Year as Oakland City Director from 1997 to 2006. He initiated and nurtured nearly 30-year-long intentional communities. Several of our students and students I've worked with over the years have taken part in Mission Year. Josh is now relocated in Charlottesville and is a parishioner at the Charlottesville Mennonite Church. You'll hear more about his involvements and journey along the way. So each will come and share with us 15 or 16 minutes of their work and their vision of peace and their practice of peace in various local settings. We look forward to your participation today. Thanks for being here.
Morning, everyone. It's great to be here at the Spring Institute on Lived Theology. I was recently on vacation with my family, and I was trying to explain to my aunt about this conference. And so I showed her our book of writings, and she misread the title, and she read the Spring Institute on Livid Theology and thought that we were all going to talk about our religious anger for 3 days. So it's good to, good to be here. So in the last 10 years or so, where I've been struggling with questions of Christian faith, politics, war, peace, poverty, social change, it's taken me from my hometown in Wisconsin to Haiti, to Northern Ireland, to rural Nicaragua, to the United Nations building in New York, and to the kitchens of countless Catholic worker homes, and now to Central Virginia. And I've generally found that Christians working for social change tend to speak one of two different languages, either the language of reform for those who seek to create change within existing structures, or the language of revolution for those with a deeper critique who feel that the current structures are beyond redemption. And so when Jenny invited me to speak a few months ago about the language and the practices of peace, I wanted to explore that tension, specifically in the context, two examples of those sort of different realms, nonviolent civil disobedient direct action as exemplified by the plowshares movement, but primarily a Catholic worker-influenced movement, and then congregation-based community organizations, specifically in the context of my experience with a community organization here in Charlottesville. And since I know you've all done all the reading in the packet, I won't spend too much time explaining those things, and we'll just dive right in into the scriptural basis of both, my perception of the strengths and limitations of them both, and hopefully a conclusion that can resolve some of these tensions all within 14 action-packed minutes. One disclaimer. I am not speaking on behalf of the Roman Catholic Church of the Incarnation, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Richmond, or anybody else. So, don't call the bishop. So, the scriptural basis of congregation-based community organizing. Within the DART model, which is the model we use, the framework of community organizing is provided by Nehemiah 5, 1 through 13. The Israelites had escaped from captivity in Babylon and were back in Jerusalem. Nehemiah served as the cupbearer to the king and is most well known for leading the Israelites in rebuilding the wall of that city. However, the passage I'm speaking of today focuses on Nehemiah's response to the oppression that developed in society after that great accomplishment. The narrative of the fifth chapter of Nehemiah begins with a great outcry among the people about usury and injustice. Next, Nehemiah goes through a process of deliberation about the concerns people had raised. Then he calls a great assembly with the community and with the magistrates, explains the people's concerns, and makes a request for change. With a large assembly gathered, Nehemiah seeks commitments from the magistrates on the issues that are causing outcry among the people. This is the model for congregation-based community organizations, such as IMPACT, the interfaith movement promoting action by congregations together here in Charlottesville. We begin with a listening process to hear the concerns of people, consider with much thought what is the best solution through research, and then at our annual Nehemiah Action Meeting, share our concerns and seek public commitments on our specific requests. The cycle repeats each year with the goal of building power as an organization and having larger and larger wins. Many benefits to congregation-based community organizing, CBCO. The first and most significant is that it's effective in creating specific changes. In the 2 years that Impact has existed, the organization has had several wins that have made concrete differences in our community, including a new bus route that provides transportation to a low-income neighborhood and to the building where social services is located, Sunday bus service on two of the most heavily traveled routes, a commitment from several health agencies to collaborate in employing a full-time dentist to provide care for uninsured adults, and increasing funding from the city for affordable housing. Everyone that I spoke to that is engaged in CBCO agree that one of the most compelling elements of this vehicle for social engagement is that every year there are concrete wins, successes which improve people's lives, and which help the organization to build power. Since CBCO's work on the local level, the changes are visible and often in our own backyards. A new bus route on Fifth Street extended, a full-time dentist at the health department. Another benefit of CBCO is that it is a vehicle for many people to be involved in the work of justice, even if they have other pressing commitments in their lives or they don't consider themselves to be activists. As a parish minister, I very much appreciate the way that CBCO allows for many parishioners of all kinds to learn about faith's call to do justice and to live out that call through something as simple as attending 3 meetings a year and being part of the Great Assembly. Through Impact, the people in the pews who attend church on Sunday but may not do much in terms of the transformation of society are invited to participate in creating concrete changes in their local community and in the process to learn about faith's call to do justice and the workings of local politics and other systems. CBCO also creates a space where very diverse groups of people can build relationships and work towards a common goal. Catholics and Protestants, Jews and Muslims, blacks, whites, and Latinos, rich, poor, and middle class are all participating in Impact. Given the racial and religious dynamics present in our state and our country, I think that an organization this diverse is beneficial simply because it creates the space for relationship and understanding. While I am very encouraged by the many benefits of CBCO, I also recognize its limitations and possible weaknesses. The biggest limitation that I see with the model of social change is that it is by definition local. CBCOs within networks such as DART, PICO, IAF, generally work for changes within localities, although that some networks are trying to link local groups in the same state to have state-level successes. However, I don't see how this model based on Nehemiah 5 could be effective in addressing national or international issues, and there are doubtless many pressing issues on that level that need to be addressed by people of faith. Furthermore, CBCO focuses on creating solutions that are winnable, not necessarily comprehensive. Since organizations want to be effective, they focus on small steps and incremental changes instead of making a bold request that may be denied. Asking for too much and not getting a win is detrimental to an organization as they seek to build power and clout in a community. I'm afraid that such an approach may lead those involved with CBCO to seek small surface-level changes when what is needed are broad, sweeping reforms or a total overhaul of a certain project. Example of this, as many of this room are aware, we have a crisis of affordable housing in Charlottesville and Albemarle, and large steps are needed in order to even begin to address that concern, but in the desire to be pragmatic and ask for something reasonable during a tight budget year, we asked for a relatively small amount of money from the county, and up to this point, our request has been denied. So in conclusion, there is much to celebrate about CBCO, creating concrete changes that people can see, empowering average churchgoers to do justice work and learn about the political process and faith's call to do justice, and bringing together people across racial, religious, economic, and political lines. However effective CBCO can be on a local level, however, the model doesn't allow for addressing national and international concerns, and the emphasis on winnable instead of comprehensive solutions may lead organizations to seek too little. Bearing in mind the strengths and the limitations of CBCO, I will now move to a very different model of social engagement, a very different language of peace, nonviolent civil disobedient direct action, as exemplified by the Plowshares movement. While the Plowshares movement clearly draws on the image of beating swords into plowshares from Isaiah and Micah, I posit that the most appropriate pericope from Scripture for understanding these actions is, in fact, Jesus cleansing the temple. The action is one of the few that is described in all four canonical Gospels. The temple in Jerusalem was a cultural power center, and while it clearly served a religious purpose, it was ultimately an economic institution, with 90% of the economy of the city being related to temple sacrifice. The temple authorities were a privileged class benefiting financially from the sacrifices observant Jews, many of whom lived in grinding poverty, were bound to offer. Mark Colville points out that Jesus' intention was to subvert and deconstruct the oppressive system, and that he wasn't simply losing his temper. Jesus clearly wasn't trying to civilly engage with the temple authorities or to invite them to make changes. He was disturbing the peace in a public, provocative way to denounce the temple system that was violating Yahweh's covenant with the chosen people. Mindful of this gospel narrative, and also of the story from Exodus of the Hebrew midwives who refused the order to kill, Plowshares activists performed symbolic, liturgical direct action. The basic elements are blood, usually their own, and hammers. They hammer on nuclear weapons and pour their own blood to unmask the systems of death and destruction. Most often, Plowshares activists become convicted felons and serve prison time for their actions and receive coverage both in religious and mainstream media. Perhaps the greatest benefit of Plowshares actions, or similar actions of civil disobedience, is its ability to dramatically confront systemic injustice in provocative ways. Michael Stone, one of my colleagues in the Diocese of Richmond, says, "Direct action has an undeniable power to confront systemic injustice. Its visceral impact can shake, and convert people to heroic action." Another colleague, Ann Gibbons, who was engaged in civil disobedience, agreed and shared that civil disobedient direct action helps wake people up. It speaks the truth to power and draws attention in a way that more socially acceptable models might not. It doesn't let society off the hook. Direct action can be a way to galvanize the public and create energy around an issue. Kim Wilkins, an Impact colleague, said that public actions can have great value in highlighting social injustices, and so I see them as potential sparks that can ignite the passion needed to actually address an issue. The action can wake people up, grab their attention, and then organizing can be done to achieve a certain goal or create spaces for public dialogue around various issues. In a soundbite culture, direct action can grab people's attention much more than a measured, slow, bureaucratic process like community organizing. I also think that direct action is valuable in undermining the legitimacy of institutions engaged in behavior that isn't life-promoting. The Pentagon, the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, based in Fort Benning, Georgia, and institutions like it have a veneer of legitimacy and respectability. What goes on inside its walls is legal, but as Liz McAllister reminds us, the crucifixion was legal, the resurrection was illegal. The making of nuclear weapons is legal. The disarming of them is illegal. What does that say about the law? Direct action and public witness can challenge this legitimacy protected by legality and perhaps begin to erode it. While it is often said that Plowshares actions and actions like it are not effective, they can sometimes have surprising concrete results. In January of 91, 2 weeks before the bombing of Iraq, Bill and Sue Frankel-Strait of the Little Flower Catholic Worker entered the deadly force area of Griffith Air Force Base in Rome, New York, where there were bombers on alert for takeoff. Bill and Sue hammered on a B-52 bomber, clearly a symbolic action, but with a very real consequence. The bomber was grounded and didn't go to Iraq. For me, it is incredible and compelling that regular people can have the power to literally ground a bomber and thus lessen the amount of destruction visited on the Iraqi people. Plowshares activist Susan Crane of Jonah House shares that a woman that used to work in a nuclear facility quit her job there after the Plowshares action at that facility, another example of change being created through symbolic liturgical action. However, as you might imagine, actions like this are not without their critics. One major critique is that often such actions are not done as a tactic in part of a larger campaign, and the focus is on the rightness of the means, not the ends of the action. My colleague Michael Stone said, "I believe that there are some in nonviolent action circles who engage in civil disobedience for its own sake. It does not appear to be part of any coherent strategy to seek change on a particular issue. Whereas Gandhi and King used nonviolent direct action carefully and strategically, Catholic Workers or Plowshares activists have been critiqued that they are less concerned about strategy and more concerned about personal faithfulness in giving public witness." Furthermore, nonviolent direct activists may not be able to effectively engage the mainstream and may be written off as just plain crazy by average Americans. My colleague Kim Wilkins points out that often these action takers are so steeped in their own language and removed from society as a whole so that communication is extremely hampered. Nonviolent direct activists with a very deep, nuanced, and developed social critique are speaking on a very different level and may be unable to bridge the gap between themselves and the average church on Sunday soccer mom audience that they seek to galvanize on issues of major global injustice. Furthermore, nonviolent direct activists often live in voluntary poverty, in community, and in other ways that set them apart from mainstream Americans, making communication and relationship all the more challenging. To these critiques, I would add one more observation. Given the prejudices in our society around race, class, ethnicity, not everyone has the same freedom to engage in direct action, nor will everyone be treated the same way by police and judges. As a white, American-born, college-educated individual who speaks fluent English, my experience of arrest and trial will be very different than one of someone who doesn't have these characteristics. In working in Hispanic ministry with Spanish-speaking immigrants on issues of justice and social change, I am reminded every day of their vulnerability as non-citizens with darker skin who in most cases do not speak English well. At the very least, educated white people who choose to do direct action should recognize the privileges that allow them to engage in such action. The question of effectiveness. Comparing CBCO with nonviolent civil disobedient direct action is challenging since they have very different underlying assumptions. CBCO seeks to be effective and strategic to build power within the existing power structure. Nonviolent civil disobedient direct action does not emphasize the question of effectiveness and focuses rather on symbolic or sacramental action, striving to work outside of the system to challenge it. These underlying assumptions merit some exploration. There's a story that is told about Jesuit activist Dan Berrigan that as he was participating in a silent peace vigil, a passerby asked him if he thought he could change the world. Dan's response was, "I'm trying to keep the world from changing me." This comment reflects the sentiment of many activists. In Thomas Merton's letter to Jim Forrest, published as A Letter to Young Activists, Merton challenges Forrest to, quote, not depend on the hope of results. The important thing, as Mother Teresa said, is not to be successful, but to be faithful. Catholic worker Chuck Trapkus said, quote, "I am not interested in forming coalitions or in building movements or in that kind of thing. I'm more interested in getting my own soul clear." Another worker, Paul Magno, agreed. "One does resistance for one's own soul, to restate your place in the world and your purpose." Comments like these make it clear that many nonviolent direct activists are not looking to be effective, but rather to respond to personal call. For Trapkus, Magno, and many others, direct action is a form of spiritual practice, and the activist is motivated by a sense of call to bear witness, not necessarily out of a goal to create concrete changes. This was very much the case for Bill Frankel Strait, who was an ordained priest struggling with the institutional church, for whom the decision to do a plowshares action was the result of internal change and the desire to, quote, do something sacramental outside of the priesthood. While I appreciate and can empathize with the thoughts that I've laid out above, I cannot help but ask if the Iraqi widow whose house has been bombed, if the Guantanamo detainee who has been held for years without a trial or even a charge, appreciate our non-complicity. The time I have spent with those impacted by local, national, and international injustices challenges me to move beyond actions which express my dissent into actions which will alleviate or reduce human sufferings caused by unjust structures. I may not be successful, but I at least want my goal to be focused on decreasing the amount of harm visited upon the Anawim of the world instead of simply on keeping my own soul clear. Studying Bonhoeffer with Charles this past semester has made me more convinced that our actions must be both symbolic and strategic, and we must seek to be both faithful and effective. Bonhoeffer, I would argue, was not ultimately concerned with making sure his own conscience was clear. On the contrary, he made the agonizing decision to join the conspiracy, unsure of if it was the right thing to do, and trusting in God's mercy in case it wasn't. Instead of preserving his own soul, he was risking it. In the face of the horrors of Nazi Germany, he was not interested in taking symbolic action to show he wasn't complicit, but in jamming a spoke in the wheel, which was causing so much death and destruction. His guiding question was not, how can I nonviolently show that I oppose the violent and unjust actions of the state? Rather, it was, how can I do God's will in this specific context of violence and injustice? While showing one's dissent and non-complicity with injustice is certainly important, I think that we as activists must also take the next step and be concerned not only with showing noncompliance, but also with practically stopping or reducing the harm of specific situations of violence and injustice. Another fundamental difference between these two practices of peace is their self-understanding in relationship to the system, related to the man that we heard about earlier this morning, which for brevity's sake I'll define as the interconnected political, legislative, economic, social power structures present in society. CBCOs are committed to working within the system to bring about incremental changes and view themselves as promoting direct democracy and engaging a large number of constituents to work with elected officials or other local decision makers. Sometimes such a model will be critiqued by those who prefer to work outside the system as legitimizing systems of power that shouldn't be legitimized. For the same reason, many anarchy-oriented Catholic workers follow Dorothy Day's model in choosing not to engage in representative democracy through voting and lobbying elected officials. Day herself said that our problems begin with, quote, our acceptance of this filthy, rotten system. And she worked to live outside of it, or at least at the very far margins of it. Following in this example, many Catholic workers and those inspired by the movement follow suit by adopting very simple lifestyles, living in voluntary poverty to avoid paying war taxes, farming, bartering, or dumpster diving for food, owning a house or property communally. They follow Peter Morin's vision of creating a new society in the shell of the old. I applaud these efforts undertaken to live a life that does less harm and the great sacrifice it entails, and struggle to implement some of these practices myself, but I still ask if we are ever truly outside the system. If I'm taking advantage of roads, educations, libraries, parks, am I really outside the system? I do not know that I could ever truly shake off all of the privilege that I am unjustly granted in this society because of my race, ethnicity, country of origin, and education level. I will close this essay with a plea for dialogue and understanding among all people of faith who are working for peace and justice. As Christians engaged in the social order, we are all guided by the dual vision of shalom and the kingdom of God, as laid out in the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, regardless of the tactics we engage. We have different ways of living out this vision, responding to this call, and I believe we must respect and recognize the value of all action faithful to this vision and carried out in this spirit. In my experience, there is all too often a rift between those who consider themselves to be working in the system and those working outside of it. Michael Stone observed that some nonviolent direct activists feel more morally superior to those who stoop to working within the political process and refuse to risk arrest. But on the other hand, those engaged in more mainstream social change work can be very judgmental towards those who are called to prophetic witness and civil disobedience. Most people that I talk to who are engaged across the spectrum felt that there is a place for both in-the-system work, such as congregation-based community organizing, as well as more provocative symbolic actions, such as those done by plowshares activists, that both approaches are valid in themselves, both essential, but neither complete. Anne Gibbons added that there is a time and season for both methods, and that prayer and discernment helps us determine when and how. In order to give an example of what greater collaboration between activists with different philosophies of social change can look like, I offer the Declaration of Peace campaign as one possible model. I am encouraged by the work of this campaign as they exemplify the willingness to work with people across the spectrum. Whether you are interested in lobbying representatives on Capitol Hill, hosting a prayer vigil, or participating in a sit-in in a congressional office, there is a place for you to get involved in working to end the war in Iraq. Furthermore, the Declaration of Peace campaign is well-organized and strategic, seeking both to perform public witness as well as creating concrete changes through legislation. In conclusion, in speaking about the situation in Germany after 10 years, as we heard about earlier, Bonhoeffer stated that what we shall need is not geniuses or cynics or misanthropes or clever tacticians, but plain, honest, straightforward men and women. I would add in conclusion that we need plain, honest, straightforward men and women who are rooted in prayer and community as they discern their vocation, who are in relationship with the Anawim that are most impacted by social injustice at all levels, and who are committed to letting the values of peace and justice inform not only their social actions, but the whole of their lives as they are engaged in struggle in whatever tactics they choose to use. Thank you.
I was awakened this morning by my wife calling to say happy anniversary to me. We were married 15 years ago, and this is the first anniversary day proper that we've been apart. I tell you that because when I tell you the story of the last 2.5 years that I'm about to tell you, you'll realize just how absolutely amazing it is that she did call me and say, I still love you. So about a year ago in May, I had a day in which a dream died. And we're going to ask the question as we tell this story as to whether God lost or whether God won. Because we can't determine the hand of providence, we won't know, but we're gonna look at that. About a year ago, I found myself sitting in this beautiful island off the coast of Portland, Maine. Now, on this island, there was a property, about a third of the island was owned by the Sisters of Mercy. The Sisters of Mercy are an order up in New England that's starting to get older, and they were selling off this property. Now, it had been a retreat center that they had had since the late 19th century, in which they had taken care of earlier orphaned girls, and then later they would just take out different girls to have retreats and to have a good time and so on. They were having to sell their property, and we wanted to buy it. We wanted to buy it as a spiritual retreat center for this community that we'd started that looked at the way that our Christian theology, our Christian spirituality, our Christian faith, how these things interact with, lead us into care for the poor and care for the earth. We'd done all the things you're supposed to do. We'd done our good networking. We had a letter from Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury, with his fabulous letterhead of Lambeth and all this stuff on it. We had all these other bishops who'd given us approval. We were doing this unusual work, not your normal parish work. We had the bishop's blessing to be in the diocese, doing something new and different, kind of a New England religious experiment, if you will. We had raised some money. We actually had a developer who was on our side. He was going to help us out. If you know what I think about suburban sprawl, well, that's, you know, there it is. But there we were, and we had this guy who was going to help us out. We were very close, very, very close. I went out to meet with the island association, the people on the other two-thirds of the island who owned summer homes. We got out there, and what we discovered that day on the island, not surprisingly, is that the way of Jesus can be a very threatening way in this world to other people. One of the people asked me, "What kind of people do you plan to bring out to our island?" I suppose it's a sign of my white privilege. I said, people with two legs. Well, no, we don't care if they have two legs. People with two, what are you talking about? And what do you mean? People who are breathing? I mean, you know, people who want to talk about the things we want to talk about. People who have an interest in this. He says, "Well, I saw you out here, you know, last year with this kid who looked really hip-hop. And I'm thinking in the back of my head, I'm thinking, you know, I'm not opposed to that, but I don't think I know anybody like that. I mean, when was I ever out here?" And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about." And of course, that was it. You know, you lied, lack of trust, we're done. I went home, and I'm thinking through this. What was the situation? And then I remembered. It was when we had done a mission project with my home church that I grew up in, this great Southern Baptist, Cooperative Baptist church down in North Carolina, and they had come up to do this mission project with us, and part of their church is they have this fabulous Hispanic ministry, and so we were out there on the island, and I took some of them out to see this place and to pray with us and all the rest, and I had this Hispanic kid with us who was about, you know, I don't know, 19, 20 years old. He had his hat on sideways, and he had his baggy pants and all the rest, and they saw him, and they all went, "Oh, we can't have that out here." And one of the guys says to me, he says, he leans over the table for dramatic effect and, you know, the whole bit. And he says, "We have a commitment to tranquil living on this island. We've worked it out in an agreement together between us, and we have codified it in the law. Far be it from God to contradict the law," right? So I look back, and I knew I'm dead at this point anyways. I might as well tell it like it is, right? And I said, "Well, I just humbly submit to you that the Sisters of Mercy have been using that property for the care of refugeed or immigrant children and for the worship of God for 100-something years. And we simply want to use this property in a way that is in keeping with its current heritage and that for which has been happening already." I mean, it's really hard to get more placid than a spiritual retreat center for, you know, care for the environment, right? We're going to have people coming out, sitting on in the woods, you know, in silence, learning how to do listening prayer. But it was nonetheless threatening. 2 years earlier, we had moved to Maine to start this community. We left the situation at the Falls Church in Northern Virginia, which was great, exciting people, young adults, people in D.C. doing all kinds of neat things, going all over the world, doing these fabulous things. My wife could walk the kids to the little library. She could walk to the post office. Wonderful people. We felt this sense of calling. So we uprooted and we went up and we moved to the Portland area. This is a good story, by the way. You guys get some faces back. You're feeling sorry. Don't feel sorry. It's a good, good story. And we moved up to the Portland area. We bought this fabulous house, this big old tavern house that was built in 1782. And just this post and beam, wonderful house. And we just had a handful of people, some who'd moved up from D.C. with us, some that the Lord had led us to find and find each other through these crazy, wonderful connections and stories that, only He could do. And, you know, we got started. And we sat down and we said, let's start. It's a slow work. It's, you know, I didn't know you until we sat down in this room together. And I'm just here because I care about this stuff and so do you, so let's sow those seeds. Let's tend that soil. Let's nourish these things. Let's tell new stories. Let's tell the stories. One of the things we did was challenge people to get their news from other places. And we started pushing them on Democracy Now!, which in some ways offended some of them for reasons that it should. You know, just what we were saying, get your news from other sources. Get things from places you're not going to know. We started doing this work. One of the major things we had to try to do was to help a lot of these folks recover their confidence in the Bible. A lot of these folks had lost their confidence in the Scripture, in the Word of God, and they believed that it was as much the source of the problem as anything else, and we had to start telling those stories, helping them to read it with different lenses, and restore their confidence in the Bible. One of the things that I found amazing as I talked with folks, as I tried to get up the energy and the money and the whatnot to get us up there and ever get us started in the first place, one of the things I found absolutely amazing was the number of people who said to me, you can't do both of those. You can't care for the earth and care for the poor. It's one or the other. They're not connected. Now, I have to confess, I was so befuddled by that that I didn't have a good comeback. I guess I intuited this works. This makes sense. I mean, God cares about them, so we should too. So, okay, why do we even have to talk about that? But they wanted to talk about it. And I found all I could really do was to throw questions back, was to say, you know, where is joy found? Why are we here? What does it mean to be a human being? What is human life for? Is there a life that's deeper and better than television, the mall, and video games? And in a way, what we did was not very dramatic, and it still isn't very dramatic. The folks are carrying on without us. It isn't very dramatic still in a lot of ways. In a lot of ways, it's just suburbanites recovering and trying to figure our way into a better way, trying to figure out how to live into a life in which our faith makes real differences and in which we just find new paths and new ways to live these things. So we went and we just looked for partners. We said, all right, we want to care for the poor. We want to be in relationship. We want to hear their stories. In Portland, Maine, there are 60-something ethnicities. Portland, strange things it may seem, Portland is one of the 11 official first ports of entry for immigrants into our country. So you go to Portland, and there are 60-something ethnicities now. This is only about a 10-year-old reality. It's a very, very different thing for Maine. Many of those folks are East African immigrants out of the Congo situation, folks from Rwanda, folks from Burundi, and there's a church, the International Christian Fellowship in Portland, Maine. Very simple things we started doing. We would take people to church. We'd go to church. They were wonderful. They just, the fact that we cared, that we wanted to hear their stories, that we just wanted to be with them, they overwhelmed us. So we'd just do these very simple things. We'd take people to church. Church would go on and go on and go on and go on. And we'd get out and we'd debrief folks over lunch. Why do you suppose their church service goes on so long? I don't know. What were they talking about? What are they singing about? Why do they sing so long? Why do they sing with so much emotion? Because given the pain that they have known, when they get in that space where they're connecting to some hope, some life, something greater, more real, and all the rest, they don't want to get out of it. we haven't hurt enough to feel that sense of wanting to stay in it. We want to hurry up and get on to the next thing. These folks are so happy to be in that space. They don't want it to end. So we were involved with the International Christian Fellowship. We did all the, you know, the little things that you typically do, and they're good things to do, but we said, Lord, you know, we want to be more involved. We want to be more challenged. We want to know some of these stories better. Charles, you watch my time for me.
Oh, okay.
So we were given a gift. We weren't really connecting at the level with some of the immigrant folks we wanted to. So we sent a message around to our prayer team, folks all over the country, especially in Northern Virginia, who had sent us up. And we said, you know, help us, pray for this thing. Well, the next day, or a few days later, but in that same week anyhow, a couple of our folks were walking across the parking lot, coming to church, and a Sudanese guy walks up to them and says, are you going to church? I need to get myself straightened out with the Lord. And this guy, Haider Wari, was a gift to us. He was just literally prayed in and given to us as a gift. Haider was your typical, if you will, poster child for the Southern Sudanese situation. He had worked for a Chinese-American international conglomerate oil company as a surveyor. He was captured by the SPLA. He was his unit of the SPLA that he was sort of stuck with was then captured by the government forces. He was beaten and threatened because they were convinced he must know something. He finally escaped on a bus through this several-day kind of, you know, epic journey on a bus ride into Cairo. He was several years in a UN camp in Cairo. He came to Portland. He married another Sudanese woman, and the struggles of life, the pain that he had seen, the fact that both of his parents had died, the separation from all the rest of his family, the responsibility he felt to provide for his sisters and send money back to Sudan, the strains of it all, he started to drink. And he began to drink. She got upset. One thing led to another. She started having an affair with a Caucasian native Maine guy, and he got locked out. He banged on the door. The police showed up. He couldn't speak English very well. He's a dark-skinned guy. He's drunk. He's in jail. We met him when he was out the first time. This led to us experiencing vicariously, in little ways, vicariously, through the life of this dear brother, the many challenges and the many realities and the amount of baggage that he had and all the stuff he had to deal with. I began to visit him in the jail. Different ones of us began to visit him in the jail. We'd find books, you know, he devoured Long Walk to Freedom and just try to find things, you know, and keep him going. He started going to the Bible study. In Portland, Maine, the prison chaplain is an African-American Pentecostal gentleman from North Carolina. Now, I don't know how that happened, but he's fabulous. He's great. And so Reverend Jeff would meet with Haider and work with Haider and all the rest. Haider has been out a few times. He's been back in a few times. He's in right now because he came home on a Saturday night, and at 1 a.m. the boyfriend was in the house, so he went out and started breaking up the windows of the boyfriend's car, and then the boyfriend came out and they got in a fight. When the police show up, well, who ends up in jail? So I'd go try to talk to Haider's lawyer. The guy didn't really want to give me the time of day. I'd do the little pathetic things I could do. I'd go talk to his probation officer, and you know, I'm just learning my way around, trying to sort out what is the situation. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm screaming up this learning curve, and we're trying to help him. Haider goes to the hearing, and he looks at the judge, and he says, "Well, judge, if you came home and found me in bed with your wife at 1 a.m., what would you do?" And you know, there's a logical consistency, Haider, to your question, but I just don't know if that's the way you want to go with this. But he should be getting out soon, and the great thing that's happened is other folks in the community have gotten so involved. We've got a lawyer who's actually really helping him, really involved, really understands his situation. Point of all that to say simply that the Lord gave us Haider, and we've been learning a lot about his pain and his struggles and the difficulties of his life involved with that. We tried to get involved on the eco side of things as well. Now, this actually, frankly, went a lot more slowly. We did, you know, the good things. We did recycling. We started doing some gardening. Folks are learning about all this. But what we discovered on sort of the eco side of life is that we were really ignorant here, and we still are. And we don't just need to know what, you know, kind of little things we can do, those are very good things to do. But we realize we really need to know a whole new way of understanding the material world. We really need to come into a sacramental understanding of what God has created and what it means. So we started to read the scriptures this way. We did a theology of water. We started looking at water in the scripture and water in the stories of the scripture. And water is a special place that, because it's liquid and malleable and uncontrollable and all the rest, God uses it in ways that he doesn't seem to use other stuff. What does that mean? What does that mean for us? How do we live with that? We started thinking about what would it be to tell a liberation theology from the perspective of the earth, still biblically faithful, you know, grounded solidly in that text, and not doing violence to that text any more than we can unconsciously not help it. But what would it mean to do that? And we'd start working with some of that stuff. We came to realize that I believe for a lot of suburban Americans, there's just really, truly a lot of fear about the outdoors. You know, when they go outdoors, where do they go? They go skiing, controlled environment. They go golfing, controlled environment. They go to these water parks, controlled environment. There's a lot of fear. What are these bugs? What are these things? What are they going to do to me? I don't want to be dirty. You know? We have lost this. We have so much lost a connection with the earth, with God's creation, what it means. So we're just on these learning curves, always looking at these biblical stories. I wish the latest one I thought of was, we've got to tell the story of the scripture through the lens of dominion, because dominion is the hinge point, right? Dominion scares the neo-pagan people to death, and dominion is the place where the fundies grind it all down and say no, no, no on the eco side. So we've got to just deal with that dominion thing. What is the message of the scripture relative to this dominion thing? Because the language is there. I wish I had time to do that, but we don't. But we just found we really got work to do in our own lives in terms of learning about God's creation and his care, or our care for that, and so on. So our community was just involved in these different ways of learning and trying to learn new ways of living and trying to learn new ways for our faith to fully form all of who we are. We had folks who never even thought politically start to do their first political actions, very small things, but for these folks, big steps. And the just nurturing, facilitating these folks as they walk into those places and as they walk into those steps. So what have we learned about practicing peace relative to our neighbors, especially those who are different from us, and relative to the creation? The first thing we've learned is that we really do have to go deep with Jesus. Because, first of all, he's there already, Matthew 25. Starting to do prison ministry was one of the best things I've ever done in the vocational ministry in which I'm called to, in which I'm involved. Jesus is the first fruits of the new creation. So when we start thinking about the creation and we start thinking particularly about dominion, dominion is given, dominion is lost, dominion is warped, it's restored through the servant one. And he's the one who has dominion. And when he comes back, it'll all get straightened out. We don't have time to talk about what that is, but he's the one who has it. So the first thing was go deep with Jesus. This whole thing that we talked about Bonhoeffer and the sense of Christ and the Scripture, and that was it. The second one was the role of story. There's got to be somewhere for people to come and join into something. I went to a large 500-person speak out against Iraq war protest at the University of Southern Maine, and got to get up at the mic and say my little part. But I, as good as it was and as good as the things that were said were, I came away nonetheless terribly saddened in spirit, because the folks were expressing angst and appropriate, understandable angst and anger, but without any, at least apparent, place for them to move into, story for them to join into, a community care, constructive place for them to be. So this role of story, and that's where we came back to trusting your Bible, recovering a sense of trust in God's Word, telling those stories biblically faithfully but with different lenses so that people could start to see things perhaps in ways that were different than they had seen them before. We were blessed because several of our folks were artists, vocational professional musicians, and we learned the role of beauty. We learned about the need. I don't know if you know Bruce Coburn, this song, Don't Forget About Delight. You know, if you're involved in all this stuff, if you're confronting the messes in the world, well, don't forget about delight and make sure you stay in some places of beauty because otherwise it's just going to ring you, ring us dry and all the rest. And there's something about being a creative person that helps us recover the Imago Dei that's skewed and buried so deeply in. The fourth thing we worked on was what does hold this all together? This thing about people saying you can't do both of these. You know, it's one or the other. Well, what holds it all together? Still working on this one. It's something about sacramental creation. It's something about the sacramental notion of history. It's something about a prayer life that walks through all of that, a prayer life that walks through every day. It's something about really having a whole new way of seeing the world. I have to say, in this sense, as a Protestant person, it has to do with still recovering from the Enlightenment. And I guess the question is whether Protestants can do that or not. I guess that's where I am on that front. But once we see the world differently, once we understand, see creation differently, then we will act differently. And I know that those two are a dynamic, not one after the other, but there's something there about getting both of those things in gear together, helping each other. I think the last thing we've learned is that even as non-threatening as we were, even as sort of, you know, simple little mundane steps we were taking and all the rest, even as much we were the front page article on the religion section of the newspaper, and, you know, it was a good story, but no pictures. I mean, what do you take pictures of? We don't have much to take pictures of. Even as much as we're not dramatic, still it made us weird to everyone. The more people got to know us, the weirder we were. And I want to say that is a very, very good thing. It is a hard thing to be a Christian, right? It's a very, very good thing that it made us weird. It was a very good thing. I actually knew the day that I went out to the island, I knew what would happen. I almost laughed at the guy because I just said, I foresee all these moments coming, and sure enough, they came. And, I think in that moment, we are an opportunity for those people to choose, and it's a crisis of judgment that we have brought to them by our mere presence. And the choice that they make, we're not judging them. We're simply standing up for truth and reality. And so what God's called us to, that's all. We're just there. We're just present. But then it makes them hit a crossroads. They have to deal with things that they otherwise wouldn't have to think about. And who they really are comes out. So, yes, it's a part of peace work, even though it's a disturbance to be there. So those are the things we've been learning. Those are the things we learned. What happened otherwise that same weekend a year ago was I came away with a sense that I had failed. I left the island, and we've been told roundly and clearly that we wouldn't be there. Did God lose that day? Well, I don't think so. I think God's bigger than their little social club, and he can work these things out. What had happened was in my own life, my wife's life, and with our children, was that we had left behind, in Northern Virginia, we'd left behind this certain kind of eye therapy that our children had needed. And we didn't think that they needed it anymore. And particularly our little guy was two when we left. We had had him checked, and he didn't need it. Well, what we'd found out in the time in Maine was, lo and behold, that he did need it. And we couldn't find it. So Cheryl and I are just really wrestling with this, and we're just really praying about this. And, Lord, what do we do? What do we do? You know, we've walked into this situation. So much of it is so good, but what do we do? Well, that same weekend that the thing crashed on the island, I got an email from a friend from high school who I hadn't talked to. I hadn't gone to any of my high school anythings. I hadn't talked to this guy in, 15 years or whatever it was. And I got an email from him who said, hey, I heard you became an Episcopal priest. You know, my church is looking for somebody. Do you want to come down here? Well, I didn't want to come down there because it was in Charlotte, and I grew up in Charlotte, and I figured I was done with Charlotte. But, one thing led to another. There was fabulous eye care just down the road, and just exactly what our kids needed. We went down and talked with them. The housing market, we've got this house to sell. Well, it turns out down the street there were these couple who were just dying to get this house. It's a famous little house in the little town we were in. Strange moves of Providence, maybe. Our beautiful Bernese Mountain Dog got cancer, and she loved the snow, she loved the cold, and we had to put her down, and suddenly we're free. So we talked with the community, we talked with the church in Charlotte, and, we said, looks like we need to make a move. Now, if you know anything about Charlotte, you know that it's pretty antithetical to Portland. Charlotte is the headquarters of Bank of America. Charlotte is the headquarters of Wachovia. Charlotte is I grew up there, so I know this story. My parents are still there. I've watched this story evolve. I've described Charlotte as the neoconservative dream realized, which, you know, you can call it heaven or you can call it hell. I have my own thoughts about that, but it is, in a sense, a place transformed by the neoconservative dream. Lord, what are you doing? I don't want to be back in that place. How am I going to do this? I don't know the answer to any of those things yet. I've been poking, building trust, and poking. You know, I've been there 6 months, so talk to people, listen to people, build trust, poke things, see what happens. I don't know, but I know that God is with us. I know he's faithful. The good news is God did not lose that day. When we sat down with the folks in our little community, we call it the Eleuthera community. Eleuthera is the Greek verb in the New Testament that means to be set free. And we said there's got to be a better way of freedom for us and for everybody else than the Enlightenment vision of liberty or the romantic vision of individual, absolute choice. There's got to be a better way of freedom, and that's with God. And so we named it Eleuthera. We figured it best to have a name that doesn't have baggage because we'll be giving it plenty of baggage as we go. And we sat down with the folks and said, so what do we do? And they said, well, we don't want this thing to end. This is the best thing we've ever found. And small as it was, weird as it was, goofy as it was, boring as it looked from the outside, they said, this is the best thing we've ever found. We're living into our faith in ways we never have before. We don't want it to go away. So people jumped in. Somebody within the community had discerned a call to ministry and is growing now, being led by the community and others into the leadership. New folks showed up, brought by the Lord to the place, who had specific gifts relative to leading nonprofits. And, you know, they're carrying on, and they're growing, and it's a great thing, and it's a good thing. I feel privileged, Cheryl and I both, very much privileged to have been able to have sown a seed that the Lord is now nurturing and growing and is living into that vision and that reality. Don't know what it means for us, but that's okay. We don't have to know that, and we won't know that. What it does mean for us is we're called to this other place right now, and we're called to, we had 2 years of what I call working sabbatical to work on some of this stuff, and now we're called into this very much different place to pick up a prophetic ministry in a different way. And right now we're finding out where does that go, and we don't know yet, but we'll find out as we get there. So, thanks.
I loom over people otherwise, so okay. This might work out better. Well, thanks. It was great to hear some attempts. I don't know how it's felt to you all, but to hear some micro stories in the midst of all these macro conversations. And unfortunately, I will not favor you with the same. We'll go back to macro. And I'll try to kind of keep things as succinct as possible. For those of you who, for me, I've spent the better part of 20 years in Oakland, California, doing inner city ministry, and I haven't seen this happen in Charlottesville yet, but on a real, real hot day in Oakland, there's this mysterious way that they built the fire hydrants so that they just open, you know, and water starts pouring out, and people play in it, and it's wonderful. And if your experience has been anything like mine, we're sitting in the midst of a fire hydrant, right? I mean, so much material and so many great thoughts. And I'll try to throw mine out. And the metaphor, of course, is can you drink from a fire hydrant? And not easily done, but hopefully we'll be able to take something away of value. Just a couple introductory remarks and a couple snapshots so you have a little sense of me, other than as a full-time father, which is how I introduced myself the other night. First, just thanks to Charles and to Jennifer for inviting all of us to be part of this and inviting me to be part of it. Many of you may know Russell Young, who has been a part of previous SILT conversations, and I bring greetings from him from Oakland. Russell's part of a church that I was involved in starting back when I was young. So greetings from Russell, who I spoke to the other day. Snapshots of me. As I just said, I spent most of the last 20 years in inner city ministry. The esteemed scholar Michael Moore made a movie called Roger and Me. For any of you who've seen it, it translates the consequences of offshoring, basically, labor to an inner city, Detroit, particularly in Flint, Michigan. In many ways, I've kind of followed Michael Moore's track in that for many years I was focused on Oakland, not thinking much about the larger dimensions of the world. 9/11 was a wake-up call in many ways, and the recognition that the consequences of what corporations do in terms of taking labor and resources elsewhere have direct consequences on your city. Kind of bridge those gaps together. If you haven't seen Roger and Me, you should definitely take a look at it. Another snapshot is, like Jonathan, I went to Iraq in 1991, however, a little bit when he was probably in junior high. I went as part of a peace team immediately after the first war. And somewhat similar to the folks in Jonathan's story, I too was saved. My life was saved by an Iraqi doctor. The Iraqi doctor happened to be in Jordan. I got appendicitis on the last day I was in Iraq, in post-war Iraq. Needless to say, this would not have been a good scenario. Fortunately, the group was going to Jordan that day, and this Iraqi doctor, who still could not tell me how he had escaped the country, right, a decade prior, operated on me and removed my appendix and saved my life. So this is another snapshot. And in this period from 90 to 91, inadvertently, really, I went on what I called a tyranny tour in retrospect. In 90, I was in Eastern Europe, and the wall had just fallen, had a chance to understand the consequences of the Soviet era. Also had a chance to visit concentration camps, and Auschwitz in particular. And anyone who's ever been to Auschwitz, I just mention it because if you've been there, you've experienced something that I don't think you can experience without going there. I then was in Iraq, as I mentioned already, saw the consequences of that kind of rule. I was in the occupied territories, saw the consequences of Israeli rule, and I was in South Africa. And Mandela had been released but not yet elected, and saw the consequences of apartheid. And so I witnessed tyranny in these five forms, and it impacted me deeply. Although not so deeply that I did much different when I came back to the United States. But impacted me deeply that, as some have suggested, Charles, and some of the statistics, my brain had no concept that folks could live in these kind of conditions and kind of fear, day in and day out. The material I want to present today is influenced by two key things. One is dialogue primarily with African colleagues. I'll explain more why the data sort of points toward Africa, particularly a young man named Yawu Tekpa, who will be a student at Bolt, at UC Berkeley Law School, who I got to know in that area, who's a refugee from Togo, political refugee, a nonviolence activist who had to flee Togo. And then more recently, a number of African Fulbright scholars who are a part of Eastern Mennonite University's Center for Justice and Peacebuilding. And they've really been dialogue partners as well as a lot of international conversations with folks I haven't ever met face-to-face, but who I'm building relationship with. And then the last thing that really informs what I'm working on is that I'm a recent convert to the Mennonite Church. And just a brief snapshot for that was finding a theology. The Mennonite Church put together in 1995 a confession of faith that I just love and it's beautiful, but don't in any way think that I speak for the Mennonite Church, because in many respects I probably adopt a theology closer to the turn of the century Mennonite Church in some respects than perhaps contemporary Mennonite Church. What I'm going to try to do then is give you a snapshot here of a project that I've worked on, as I said, kind of post 9/11. So really for 6 years. To do that in about 5 minutes is going to be tricky, but I'll do my best. A lot of this material is on the web. I use a website primarily, eucharism.org is the primary site. There's some stuff that you may be particularly interested in. We had a conversation this fall, a number of colleagues and I, with Archbishop Tutu. There's a transcript of that conversation about Mennonite you know, applied Mennonite theology in the context of, in that case, Zimbabwe. Anyway, that's ways to look at more resources. The big thing I love, and the reason I'm thrilled to be here, is just the call. It's interesting, the conversation came toward martyrdom. The huge task that Charles talked about of forming people, the call that me and my colleagues are trying to flesh out is one that involves tremendous risk, and don't want to go about that nonchalantly. And really need the feedback from folks in this room as well as others to craft that in a way that's a contribution to the church. One of the ways of framing the huge task is we're trying to end the era of Constantinianism. It's a minor project. I would define Constantinianism as the comfortable marriage between state power and Christian faith. When these two are interwoven and wed together, and people benefit from the fruits of exploitative Christian marriage to state power. We have no illusions that we can that a handful of Christians can try to actually reverse that. But what our hope is that we could actually at least make it so that it's not a comfortable marriage. It's an uncomfortable marriage. That we're providing a bit of discomfort in those relationships. To frame out the politics that I'm approaching this with in ways that may be foreign, I think, for quite a few folks in the room, I want to just briefly point back at Eugene's talk yesterday. I told Eugene that I thought he had given a great sermon, just like Charles said, but that I was skeptical of what he said as a public policy statement. And what I've meant by that is, and this is very much an Anabaptist vision, that that the message I heard Eugene speaking is a message I believe the church deeply needs to hear. And it's a message for the church by and large. And that's where things get tricky, is what messages are for the church, what messages are for the world. And I'm pointing in a slightly different direction than probably most people in the room by a couple statements here. I don't think Jesus is surprised that the empire is the empire. Okay? I don't ever see Jesus say, "Oh my God, those Romans, you know, they're doing it again, they're executing, you know." So what Jesus is infuriated by is when the people of God are not the people of God. This is when we hear his harsh message. And so what I've written here is I say the call of Christians is to another politics, that even the beautiful nonviolent coercion of the minority that many of us participate in through voting, okay? I'm calling for Christians to disengage from what I call the politics of coercion that manifests itself extremely beautifully in the form of voting, and to instead engage in a different politics. And the politics, as I define it, and this runs very close to Eugene again, is I call it a politics of life-giving, life-giving. And the phraseology of that is, if you haven't looked at it in a paper, is, and actually there's two copies of some of this work on each of the tables, some of the updates of this work on each of your tables. Life-giving, life-giving is simply life-giving in one word, which means the pursuit of joy, and life-giving, two words, meaning the laying down of our lives. And the scriptural context for that I look at is Hebrews 12, where it says, "For the joy set before him, Jesus endured the cross." Okay? So for the life-giving pursuit of joy, Jesus gives his life. And I'm arguing that this is the politics that the church, and uniquely the church, is called to. The other phrase I use here is, "In remembrance of Jesus' life, crucifixion, and resurrection, fathers of Jesus pursue the joy set before those faithfully broken in solidarity with others." This is the kind of core call to a new politics, to distance ourselves from the politics of coercion and instead embrace the politics of life-giving, life-giving. There's a new section in the papers. There's only two copies on your table. Whoever's most interested, grab it. But there's a new section in the papers on your table that wasn't included in the section that you may have read. And it's titled The Imitation of Intervention. And it's an important section only because in that I'm looking at the Philippians 2 passage where it says Jesus surrenders his power, becomes human, takes on flesh, is faithful even to the point of death. And it's kenosis is the title that's often given to it, the kenosis passage. Jesus effectively embracing nonviolence as his form of ministry to humans. Another way of framing the argument I'm making is that we do a disservice to this passage if we see it only as a kenosis passage, a passage that talks about nonviolence. That in order to correctly understand this passage, we also have to understand it as a kairos passage, meaning a recognition that Jesus doesn't just stay aloof in the heavenlies, but Jesus crosses the border. He intervenes in a cross-border raid, and a nonviolent cross-border raid, into our world. And how do we, and much of the question I'm raising is, how do we imitate that? And how do we balance the kenosis and the kairos? And for those of you that are in the thick of the theological world, the way I try to frame that then is that Niebuhr, whose name has come up a couple times, and Stout, I argue, are trying to compromise the Christian call to kenosis by calling us to kairos, okay? And I would argue that Hauerwas and Yoder often compromise the Christian call to kairos by calling us to kenosis, okay? Meaning, by calling, to translate that one more time, the overemphasis on nonviolent action can lead to a passivity that doesn't protect the oppressed. The overemphasis on protecting the oppressed at any cost can cause us to abandon nonviolence. The question is, how do we bring these two together in ways that that allows us to see the church as church? This is just words related to, again, Eugene Stock. The question is not how do we compel unbelievers to reject free markets. And my passing comment is, Jesus does not overturn the tables of the Roman marketplace. Okay? He overturns the tables of the temple. It's an important distinction. The question is, how do we, through the power of the Holy Spirit, assist believers to trust God enough to embody the economy of generosity that meets and transcends justice? If we take our cues from Jesus' focus on the faithfulness of God's people, we are led to believe that God's strategy for social change is rooted in voluntary embodiment by the people of God, rather than in asking the state to compel the general public to be more Christian than the Christians. Okay? So, arguably Anabaptist, definitely very different vision of politics than perhaps most in the room. Elul says it this way, the Christian's first act of nonviolence is that he or she refrain from asking others to live as if they were Christians. That's how I affirm that comment. The critical question then in my mind is, how can the transnational church be the church for God's sake, for the sake of one another, and for the sake of the world? And central to correctly understanding our world, so much of what I've read from your work and heard, I deeply affirm. In order to try to give a framework for how we might understand our world, one of the key things that I've tried to look at is the word empire, which has become extremely fashionable and extremely undefined. And in order to try to define what the word what that word empire looks like, I included a little diagram that my colleagues and I had worked out. If you have the books and you're in that section, you can look at page 3 of what I gave you all. And it's an attempt to look at the fundamental structures of exploitation in our world today. In the back of the ones that are on your table, there's actually a correlation between the slave era in North America and the way that we maintain slavery. I argue that white people maintain slavery today. It's just we don't do it on our own soil. And we do it through this system. And so the system of, I call it empire of exploitation, begins with consumers on top, begins with my complicity, effectively, continues through the marketing powers that be, continues through the policies of democratic governments, continues through the multinational corporations, and often these days, the multinational corporations are in league with authoritarian or totalitarian governments that effectively are the union busters of our world for approximately 2 billion people. Okay? So 2 billion people do not have the capacity to sell their labor freely, to steward the resources of their own country, because there's a handful of elite folks who we prop up through our consumption who are unaccountable to their own citizens. At the end of that, instead of having, we used to have slave states here in North America. What you have now is you have state slaves. Okay? So I would argue 2 billion people on the planet, a third of the planet, they're effectively enslaved on our behalf. This diagram exceedingly helps us if you're trying to understand 9/11, because if you grew up in Saudi Arabia, you know that this system means that the folks, the citizens of Saudi Arabia themselves, are utterly voiceless in the governance of their own country.
Actually, most of the citizens of Saudi Arabia live pretty well. But most of the work on their ground is done by Filipinos and Pakistanis, who are effectively slaves.
Yeah, and they're well, and one thing that's fascinating, it's this is Saudi Arabia is the only country that fits into this grid, is that you have both significant wealth in the hands of the general populace and no political voice. And most of us know, you know, taxation without representation, basically voicelessness leads to violence. It's a pretty historically correlated equation. Voicelessness leads to violence. And so the question is, how do we, as part of the transnational church, magnify the voices of the slave states, and how do we challenge this system of exploitation at every stage? And as you can see in the diagram, Christians are complicit in this system at every stage. How might we begin to do that? And let me read the abstract for you real quick, and then I'll jump into to the ideas. So the abstract of summary of these ideas, which is on the two copies that you got. The primary source of injustice in our world is the greedy alliance of those engaged in uncaring consumerism, the politics of coercion, corporate exploitation, tyranny, war, and passive pacifism. This system of exploitation relies on authoritarian governments who leave 2 billion people politically voiceless and economically impoverished. They are the poorest of the poor. When I use that phrase, I'm referring specifically to both economic impoverishment and political impoverishment. So poorest, they're poor at a different level than even the most impoverished in India, for example. Governments that are unaccountable to their citizens persistently produce terrorism, poverty, exploitation, war, genocide, refugees, corruption, and environmental harm. These governments waging often hidden civil wars against their citizens are far more likely to engage in international conflict. The first priority of those seeking peace is dismantling this empire of exploitation by assuring government accountability through the free exercise of God-given dignities of all citizens. Obviously, in the work, I unpackage all those phrases a whole lot more. In the back of the two copies you received is what I call the Felix Index, which was just an attempt to take a number of human rights indices, combine them into one, so that we can look through the lens of what governments on our planet are least accountable, and then raise the question, which ones claim to be led by Christians? The second half, then, where we start to talk about how might we respond of the abstract is, Christians fuel much of this outsourcing of slavery to satisfy Christian consumers addicted to exploited resources. Some Christians working in governments and unjust corporations regularly collude with dignity disrespecting Christian dictators. This essay imagines Christ-like opportunities to unite the transnational church in seeking the abolition of the 1700-year era in which those who profit from tyranny were largely unchallenged in their claims to follow Jesus. These faithful opportunities are rooted in the God-given dignity of all people and Jesus' call to be life-giving servants rather than tyrants. The primary method proposed is a loving practice of the rule of Christ, which is an Anabaptist phrase for Matthew 18. If someone offends you, you go to them in private. If you're still unreconciled, you bring another and then tell it to the church. Okay, thanks. With complicit Christian consumers, corporate executives, politicians, and dictators, nonviolent transnational direct action in solidarity with oppressed citizens encourages forms of government accountability most likely to end civil oppression, international wars, and the global system of exploitation. So the goal, again, is, and I'm really going to cut, the goal is to discomfort, in some form of Christian witness, all those who benefit from this system. as outlined. The way that we've tried to begin to imagine what that might look like, we're in the process of putting up a website called, and the data is in the back of the two copies that are on your table, called exploiterempower.org. And what it does is allow consumers to look up whatever country the products come from, and on the basis of the data that we've accumulated, then tell them, effectively, by buying a product from this country, you've likely exploited people or empowered people. And there's gradations of that throughout. We can predictably say, by filling your gas tank with oil, you've effectively exploited quite a few folks, most likely, even though it doesn't have a label on it. We're doing that so we can make consumers uncomfortable with their complicity in the system. With corporate heads and with Christian dictators, of which there's, according to, again, the data we use, there's 9, quote-unquote, Christian-led dictatorships and the 30 least accountable governments. 8 of those 9 are in Africa. Belarus is the exception. Zimbabwe is the most visible example right now, and the one that I'm most familiar with and most in dialogue with. What we're attempting to imagine is, how do you practice Matthew 18 with Robert Mugabe? How do you practice Matthew 18 with the head of, with the Christian head? I think Eugene someone was telling me last night, with the Southern Baptist head of a major corporation. And the way we've imagined doing that is exactly what the scriptures say, which is go to them in private, have a private conversation. If they refuse the private conversation, or if they reject the call for transformation from a tyrant to a servant, as Jesus teaches us, then to bring others, ideally denominational leaders. We were hoping that the Pope would fly into Harare and talk to Robert Mugabe for us. We think that would be pretty interesting. And if that doesn't work, then begin to, both in North America, outside of the church, and this is a conversation with corporate leaders too, to begin to do what we call dignity witnesses, which is a nonviolent, outside of the home church of the corporate leader here in North America or Europe, and outside of the home church of the dictator, Mugabe, whoever, to simply begin as Christians to engage in a nonviolent transnational witness. One of my colleagues at EMU is planning for how to mobilize Zambians to cross the border into Zimbabwe to be part of this process. And that witness would simply be saying, hey, this is not the rule that Christ calls us to. And as such, we're trying to counter this complicity that runs throughout this system. Last thing I'll say, and then we're done. And that is just to bring it home, since everyone quotes Bonhoeffer, right? I gotta do it too. Except I'm going to do it in a very different way, which is to say, I talked to Bonhoeffer the other day. And I talked to Bonhoeffer the day before that. And I talked to another Bonhoeffer a few weeks, because these Bonhoeffer lives today. In these settings, these folks are suffering under Christian-led, you know, just like the Nazis, and often just as horrific. These Christian brothers and sisters are suffering at the hands of Christian-led dictators that we help keep in power. And so we don't have to talk about, well, what would we have done in the face of Hitler? Because we can do it now. You know, they're all around the planet. And like Charles, we're often unaware. And so that call to awareness and the call to this great task of forming people who would reject the complicity in this system and confront our brothers and sisters is what we're trying to work on and imagine. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your stories and your dreams and ideas, ideals, failures, successes, nuts and bolts, strategies. And I encourage all of you, as we break now for lunch, to fold these into your conversations, and let's continue coming back to some of these themes. And thanks to all of you for your time.